All right, ladies and gentlemen. As you know, this evening, it is our purpose to draw attention to certain cognate concepts in Western and Tibetan Buddhist traditions, primarily, or at least ostensibly, concerning the after-death states, but really in a wider sense, we want to call attention to a metaphor that relates to all of reality, whether in the flesh or out of it. However, first it may be useful for us to address ourselves just for a short time to the whole issue of death and the death states. It is a fairly trite statement, a sort of a trite truism, fairly often repeated, that there are only two certainties in life, death and taxes. And it seems that the Internal Revenue Service takes care of the certainty of one, and there are all sorts of other services of an other nature, even more enduring and awesome, that take care of the former. And while the only mysterious thing about taxes is the question how we manage to pay them, death holds really much more profound mysteries. And so attention of people throughout the ages has frequently and quite understandably focused upon death. But in some systems, indeed in many, way in which particular culture or religion dealt with the possibilities that exist after death became also a sort of revelation concerning their model of reality in general. And so we find, for instance, just to kind of fish around a little bit, in the background of our own Western culture, we find that the ancient Greeks had a very nebulous concept about life after death, such as it may be. They spoke of something called Hades, and they stated that the shades of the dead would go to Hades, and that they would be ferried across a river by a certain boatsman, Charon or Charon, and so forth. But then they didn't say very much about what happens after that. And their notion was a kind of not particularly pleasant lingering and drifting about of the souls, I believe, in this state. Really not a particularly interesting or desirable condition to look forward to. In fact, I am quite convinced that to a major extent the later Western Christian concept of purgatory was very much modeled on the Hades of the Greeks. Not really a place of torment, but a kind of waiting, a kind of drifting about, a somewhat melancholy condition where one hopes that eventually it will come to an end and something of a more exciting and more glorious character will emerge from it later on. If we look at the other element in the background of Western culture, we'll find the Hebrews, who had, and really for the most part still do in the Jewish religion, again have very little concept of the afterlife. Oh, there were such things as Sheol, which is arises as a kind of an ill-defined concept in Judaism from time to time, and which is, again, rather like Hades, not at all clearly delineated, peculiar place that appears much more like an interim state than anything else. On the other hand, when we look to the ancient Egyptians, or even also the ancient Babylonians, we find a much more complex and very, very clearly defined ideas about what happens after death. And of course, all over Asia, well, not really all over, but primarily in India and the areas that were influenced by India, we have the strong involvement in the re-embodiment, the reincarnation idea, which is primarily an Indian idea. It's not even particularly prominent in the other branch of the Aryan peoples in ancient Persia. And I for one, must go on record saying something that certainly is not said very often in places such as this, that to regard reincarnation somehow as some kind of a universal heritage and universal belief of the human race that has just been repressed at certain times is utter nonsense. It is primarily an Indian idea. It doesn't fit into a heck of a lot of other religious teachings the world over. It's a peculiarity of a certain religious orientation, and it's not peculiar to some of the others. And particularly from ancient Egypt then comes our model of a whole complex and very mythological and really also at the same time very cosmological and philosophical description of what happens to the soul after death, as found in the famous papyrus of Anu, which came to be called by some of the scholars, I think sort of in the 19th century, the Egyptian Book of the Dead. This name I'm primarily bringing up because in order to indicate a certain analogy, when some of the first translations of the Tibetan Bardo were made, the Bardo Tudul, such as by the great fellow Californian, the late great scholar Dr. Evans Wentz, he gave it the title rather arbitrarily, but sort of, I'm sure it helped to sell books and call attention to the work, the Tibetan Book of the Dead. We have, by way of these titles, a juxtaposition of a certain models of being and of reality and of change, at first in Egypt, and then in Tibet, which deal with the experience of death and dying in considerable detail. So, we need to address ourselves now to the Tibetan Book of the Dead. The design that I have for your delectation there, as miserable as it looks, is one in which a certain model of reality that arose in a kind of late form of Jewish teaching called the Kabbalah or Kabbalah is superimposed upon the three major regions of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and I, in the course of our discussion, it will become clear to you that there is a rather interesting convergence here of two models of reality and of being. But let's look at, since this is a series about Tibetan Buddhism. I don't want to complicate the situation unduly, and so we need to address ourselves to the Tibetan model, and then we will see in what a curious way this relates to another archetypal esoteric model. So the Bardo or Bardo Tudol of Tibet, while it has been called a Book of the Dead, is in many ways also a book both of death and of life. It is based on the complementary relationship between the experience of life and the experience of the after-death state. To the Tibetans, even as to the Chinese, the idea that there could be this kind of a long involvement of consciousness in what we call life, without a balancing and complementary involvement in another state that might be called the state after death, or the condition between death and rebirth, would seem preposterous. Just like the Chinese would say that in accordance with the Taoist model of the yin and the yang, the two halves of the great circular model of reality, life must always be balanced by something else. Manifestation, the outward activity in the light of consciousness must be balanced by a withdrawal into the darkness. Even as the darkness is balanced by the light is balanced by the darkness. And this is very much the attitude underlying the Tibetan Buddhist thinking also. The idea that there should be in addition to the experiences and the activities of the individual in the body, while in the body, in activity, so that there should also be an other side outside of the body, is a perfectly not only a perfectly acceptable idea, but a necessary idea. To conceive of life without death would be a violation of the system of balance upon which reality is based. Somehow, with its one-sidedness, the West, especially after a certain period of its historical development, is not able to perceive things within the light of that kind of a balance. And we have an orientation somehow always toward life and more life, and either a denial or a minimizing or a shunting aside somehow of death. And we do that in innumerable ways. Just take a little drive. You won't even have to spend a lot of gas from here. Kind of drive down in that direction, and you'll get to the great necropolis, the city of the dead, euphemistically called Forest Lawn. Probably one of the most ingenious, disgustingly ingenious ways in which anyone at any time in the history of the world managed to camouflage the existential reality of death. There are these tiny little plaques in the ground that might just as well, commemorate how somebody met somebody or somebody made love to somebody on the lawn there at one time or the other. And it's actually, that marks the spot where somebody has died. And then you Well, you come there to visit like a tourist, and you watch this frightful, atrocious, huge travesty reproduction of one of the great works of art from another part of the world. And then you have all of these little churchlets there that are kind of replicas from elsewhere. And wouldn't you believe it? I mean, if I went somewhere to maybe one of these Eastern European countries and told them, what do people do there in these churchlets? In the midst of all that death, they get married. They get married, you know? As if marriages were not moribund enough as it is, you know? I mean, you might know that they eventually end up on the rocks, but to start them on the rocks kind of that way, I don't know. That in itself is a total symbolization of the peculiar, inadequate way in which we treat the entire subject matter of death. The constantly changing but ever-present health fads that are in our midst, in which respect, again, I think this country is fairly unique. In every decade or so, it's something else. But it's always there. It's always there, whether it's the jogging or the stupid Evian water bottles or whatever. It's always there, and it's somewhat underneath it. There is always the assumption that if we just do something, or on the other hand, avoid doing something else, we might not die. We might not die. This is a kind of arrogance mingled with apprehension that arises in the mind of a group of people who are very, very one-sided and who are always looking at the side of activity, at the side of the external, what is out in the light, and who have no capacity and no willingness to deal with the other side of things, the dark. Now, I have always liked, personally, I've always liked the city lights. And I always, as a child already, I was very attracted to the idea that there's a place, you know, this city, especially in a city where it rains a lot, like in Budapest, where around there where I grew up, that the pavement is always glistening, or often is glistening with wetness, and all these lights up, that there is a way of turning the dark night into something that is full of light. That is the way, in that childish way, that we all think. And that's why we have lights everywhere. The city lights, the way we can't even see the stars over the city, these are all a manifestation that we are oriented toward the daylight, and we want to deny the dark night as much as possible. And the dark night to the light of physical life is death. We want to deny it. Other people have an entirely different orientation. What is experienced in life is revealed after death. They see a connection. And what is not revealed after death, they often say, then must be experienced in life again. And that is sort of the rationale for reincarnation. So that the two phenomena, life and death, are complementary opposites of one another. And that they cannot be, one of them cannot be imagined without the other. They belong together. For instance, in the Hindu Bhagavad Gita, it is said that death is certain for the living, and rebirth is certain for the dead. And therefore, one should not grieve over death. Buddhism holds a concept that is somewhat more subtle. It postulates three possibilities. One, embodied life. Second, disembodied life, or the death, or the state after death. And the third one, liberation, or the passing of the spirit beyond both life and death into nirvana, which is often enlightened as the ultimate light, the ultimate white light of the Supreme Buddha, the Buddha light. And we talked the last time about the great symbol of the wheel of life and death, where we have within that wheel, we have both the embodied state and the disembodied state. There are the humans who are in their bodies. There are the animals who are in their bodies. And then there are the hungry ghosts who are the humans who are out of their bodies. And then there are out of their bodies but very desirous of physical things. You know? They just go around sometimes, some of the Buddhist communities in the city here. I used to be very close to one of the Vietnamese temples because I taught at Oriental Studies, College of Oriental Studies, and that was run by a Vietnamese monk who was the head of it, the late Professor Thien An of blessed memory and others. And we used to go around to the various little temples there, and you have those pictures, the Vietnamese pictures of the hungry ghosts. They are really wonderful. Yeah. They look sort of like E.T. They have a kind of large skull that's sort of all mouth, opens from ear to ear because they are so hungry. And then the rest of it, all skinny, tremendously wasted, like their arms are real thin, like a thread or something of that. So then they're floating around with their mouths open, you know. And when one goes to the altar, the particular altar of the hungry ghost, then one always brings food. And the folk belief is that while, of course, they can't eat the physical food, that they somehow partake of a kind of a psychic essence that comes from the food, and that they are a little bit helped by that. Very, very heavy purgatorial idea. And then, of course, we have also the souls that went to the heavens, hells, which are worse even.